Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials. In this, its third series, we will focus on conversations that treat the problem of the environment, climate change, and mass extinction. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. The decision of the High Court of Australia in Mabo versus Queensland No. 2 was handed down on the 3rd of June 1992. This week marks its 30th anniversary, and I thought how better to mark this occasion than by having a conversation with Professor Irene Watson, who belongs to the Tanganakald, Maintang and Bungandij First Nations peoples in South Australia. Irene has been a consistent and influential critic of the Mabo case and other legal regimes that have been applied to Indigenous Australians. I will say more about Irene shortly, but first let's have some basic facts about the Mabo case. This was the first decision of the Australian High Court to recognise that Australia's Indigenous peoples had a pre-existing interest in the land and waters that the High Court called native title. In order to recognise this pre-existing interest called native title, the High Court had to go back in Australian legal history and give an account of the foundation of Australian law. And this is where the case became so significant for constitutional lawyers and those thinking about the colonial and post-colonial history of Australia. The first significant move that the High Court makes in the majority of judgments is to declare that the assertion of sovereignty over Australia by the British Crown is not justiciable in a municipal court. That means that the very question of founding Australia, asserting sovereignty over it, is not a question that the court can address. But notwithstanding this, the Australian High Court then had to face the fact that the foundation of Australia is a void in legal terms, albeit one that is filled with multiple accounts of violence and dispossession of the Indigenous population. The court tried to draw a line between the decisions and judgments of what they called courts in the hierarchy of empire. In other words, a sort of colonial past and what the court imagined would be a sort of post-colonial future, one where Aboriginal interests in land and waters is now recognised. While it recognised that there was a form of interest in land and waters called native title, the High Court also declared the terms of extinguishment. So what it gave with one hand, it took away with another. Wherever title to land had been granted by various colonial authorities, that title would, for the most part, supersede and be hierarchically superior to native title. Moreover, in order to establish native title, Indigenous claimants would have to demonstrate a continuing physical connection with the land, as well as the fact that the ways in which the land or waters was used was consistent with Aboriginal law and custom. This was a near impossible condition for most Indigenous groups, or for many Indigenous groups, to meet because of the genocidal policies of removing children from Aboriginal families and communities, the so-called stolen generation, that had been in place since the late 19th century. So along with the massacres and slaughter of Indigenous peoples, there was also a cultural genocide that, to a large extent, would prevent many Aboriginal communities from meeting the very strict conditions of having native title recognised. This was the extraordinary conceit of the Mabo judgment. A law that could not give an account of what lawful authority acquired the territory of Australia was purporting to set conditions for recognising Indigenous interests in land, provided that interest would have a subordinate place in the ongoing colonial legal system. Now, why is the Mabo case of significance in this series of discussions on the environment, climate change, and mass extinctions? Well, one of the things that the Mabo judgment and the native title legislation which followed it enabled was a continuation and indeed acceleration of extractive industries and mining operations in Australia. Indigenous peoples who claimed native title gained a right to negotiate on future acts on the claimed land. And this was a mechanism by which successive governments enabled mining companies and other extractive operations to get on the ground, explore for minerals through the licenses they had been provided, and ultimately to continue with the extractive operation. Irene Watson refers to the relative power imbalance between large corporations and their lawyers negotiating so-called land use agreements with Indigenous communities. In most instances, the outcome of this is a foregone conclusion that Indigenous communities receive very little by way of royalties, and the extractive process generally continues unabated. But there is a deeper and more profound truth to be drawn from reflecting on the Mabo judgment and the years that followed. The subordinate status that had been allocated to Indigenous law was part of the problem. If we are to address the catastrophic destruction of ecosystems, then the relative status of life and non-life has to be thought differently. The question of what it means to live lawfully in Australia needs to be posed again, and the answer to that cannot involve the hierarchical domination of Indigenous law by Australian colonial law. And this is something that I discuss at length with Irene. The 30th anniversary of the Mabo decision comes just as Australians have elected a new government headed by Prime Minister Albanese. His first promise as Prime Minister-elect was to implement a regime of a voice for Indigenous people in Parliament and to explore the need for truth and a treaty in Australia. If Australians are to get it right this time, or at least fail better in its modes of recognising Indigenous Australians, then it does need to reflect on the past 30 years and listen to voices such as that of Professor Irene Watson. Irene's work with her community, her activism and legal thinking stretch back over 40 years. I begin by asking her what it was like to be studying law in the 1980s in Adelaide, and this is by way of setting the scene for our discussion of the Mabo case and what we have to learn about addressing the crises of climate change and mass extinctions today. Irene Watson, welcome to Countersign, and thank you for giving me your time. When I arrived in Adelaide back in 1997 to take up a lectureship at the University of Adelaide, and I walked into the law school building, the Lidgettwood building, I entered a room called the Irene Watson room. And I wondered who Irene Watson was and why this room was named after her. And very soon after that, when I asked about it, I found out that Irene Watson was the very first Aboriginal person to graduate with a law degree from the University of Adelaide, one of the oldest universities in Australia.
And that Irene was the first Aboriginal person to graduate with a PhD in law from the university.
And that was back in the 1980s that you were studying law, Irene. And I wanted to get a sense from you of what that was like. What did you encounter in terms of legal studies in Australia in the 1980s? What was the sort of epistemology and political context in which you were studying law?
Well, I began studying law at Adelaide Law School in 1979. Mm-hmm. And it was stating the obvious, 1979, but it was a predominantly and remains predominantly a white privileged space, probably more so then because it was Adelaide was the only law school. And it was just full of private school students back then. Mm-hmm. There has been some shift in terms of a broader socioeconomic outreach now that there are two other law schools. But generally it was a very white privileged and openly in a kind of, can you say it, openly polite racist way? But that mm-hmm. was the feeling. There was mm-hmm. open racism, but it was contextualized as a joking kind of, what was it like? It was the colonial frontier. It was hostile. It was aggressive. It was doing me a favor, enabling or allowing an Aboriginal woman to enter the law school and to sit amongst and study them. It was quite. It was all the things that I expected it was, because it was, it was the kind of general Aussie ochre racism of the time,
Yes.
But it had a kind of refined way of being within, Adelaide establishment law school. And Adelaide at that time and still today is a real colonial relic of the imperial past, ongoing present.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's obviously a state with also that long colonial history of pastoralism, large properties, landed families sending their children, as you say, to private schools and then on to the University of Adelaide. Mm. And you had grown up also in South Australia, so you would have been kind of familiar with these kinds of structures and systems of domination from when you were growing up, possibly.
But not such a close encounter. I mean, it was interesting to be in a lecture theatre in those close encounters and to be able to observe white power and white privilege at such close range. From my own educational background, I didn't have access to see that. So it was what it was, an interesting study of white privilege.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the law you encountered, I mean, we'll go on to talk about Mabo and the developments that followed in the early 1990s. But what was the experience of studying law itself, in terms of the content? Because you obviously were coming to legal studies with your own law, carrying your own law with you. And what was that encounter like in when you were studying?
In thinking about law, I always went to study law, not to, even then in the 1979, I never studied law to become a lawyer and to do lawyering. I was always, for me, it was, the need was to understand the colonial legal language of how they did it, how they colonized, how they captured an entire continent, and the justification for that. I mean, we knew the justification, you know, for that. Mm-hmm. But I needed to understand the technique, the technicalities for that first. So for me, it was always that was always my thinking back then, was to understand. I mean, we've had conversations about this as well, that to really critique mm-hmm. colonial legal systems, positivism, you know, structural systems of law, one needs to understand how they are structured, how they've come to be. So that was always my thinking, was to understand, because at that time in the 1970s, not much has changed. You know, the land, the position of dispossession from land, the theft of land, the theft of lives, the colonial violence, the high levels of imprisonment, all of that. It was always a need that I had to better understand and translate how that had come about. Sorry, I'm just trying to track back to your question. So that was my thinking coming into that space.
Mm-hmm.
And coming into that space was pretty much all that I imagined it to be, because I'd also previously a number of years of involvement with the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement, which was established.
That's right. I wanted to come to that.
In the early 1970s, it was sort of modelled on, you know, developments that had come out of Aboriginal Redfern, where mm-hmm. which was a response to initially high levels of incarceration of Aboriginal peoples, high levels of being unrepresented, of a pattern of Aboriginal people pleading guilty. You know, there were never, very rarely Aboriginal people represented. So the early, late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of groundswell in, particularly in Redfern, which went on to model Aboriginal legal services, you know, across the country. And so I was involved in some of that movement in the early 70s. When the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement was established, so I had all of that background, and decided that I wanted to do law, understand the language, but also I think I came at it from a community development model rather mm-hmm. than wanting to participate in the whole system of lawyering. Because I did have a reasonably sophisticated understanding of and low expectation of participating within the legal system as a remedy for the effects and the destructive effects and impact of colonialism.
Absolutely. And I think that period that you emphasize, late 60s, early 70s, the development of the legal representative bodies for Aboriginal people, as you say, you know, building on what had been done in Redfern in Sydney, focusing on incarceration in particular. And I think then in the late 1980s was also the period of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Debts in Custody, which again was a huge problem and remains so, that so many Aboriginal, young Aboriginal people die in police custody. Mm-hmm. So that was also part of the context in of the time frame where discussing. But very, very soon after you finish your legal studies, or at least your undergraduate studies, we have the handing down of the Mabo number two decision by the High Court of Australia. And just to give a little bit of context to that decision, was the first decision of the High Court of Australia to recognize a, and I choose my words carefully here, a species of title that would be cognizable to colonial law, to white law. And it had to develop this mode of recognition to say, even though Aboriginal people, from their point of view, have had sovereignty over the territory, retain a very substantial connection to land and country, this was the first time that Australian law was recognizing that relationship, but it was recognizing it in a way that made it subordinate as a form of title to the overall system of land tenure in Australia. But when it was handed down, I mean, I was a student, I was still in my doing my undergraduate studies in law in 1992. It was a very significant moment. So I was wanting you to both reflect on the moment, but also to perhaps talk about the judgment.
Well, you know, I remember the week when it was handed, when the judgment came down, and we were, you know, many of us had been looking at it and were aware of what it was. And it was interesting, the kind of media performance of Mabo within the public imaginings of recognition, Aboriginal title, you know, the fury that went with that, of you know, the possibility. I mean, it's a real caricature, really, of colonial power and how how the play with that, the colonial imaginings, and it's not imagining that this notion of Aboriginal people now being positioned and propelled to take back the land. I mean, that's where we need to pause and think about the largesse of that lie. How absurd, and that those moments, those lies that are perpetuated by the, you know, which also reveals that the kind of nature of the colonial system itself, and it's and how it is so interconnected across its own society, its own constructed society, and all of the elements of that it's a societal fear of this, you know, and playing on this fear of there's 1,000 blacks out there that are coming to attack and spear you and take everything from you. And the justification for the colonial violence from, you know, from the time of Cook, and the kind of intergenerational kind of character and nature of that way, that colonial way of being, and how it got played out in Mabo. So we saw that. I saw that. A number of us saw that. And it was interesting. For those who saw it, ended up having very, very little critical voice to, you know, to express and have a rational, legal conversation about how this is impossible, and that, in fact, embedded in the heart of Mabo itself is the guarantee that the colonial framework, you know, the skeletal framework of colonialism itself will always be maintained, regardless of the genocide and the colonial history of violence in this country. And some of the pitter-patter that was revealed in the Mabo decision, that the question of of the theft of an entire continent and the genocide, the attempted genocide of its peoples, is a question which is non-justiciable. Yeah. So we never got a when did we have a real conversation about that, other than in the kind of writings that some of us small conversations we were able to have. I've always said to have a conversation about the truth of Mabo was like, you know, trying to kick a goal, you know, at an AFL grand final, you know, trying to be heard in a moment of great loud otherness. It was impossible. It was impossible. And for those who tried to have those conversations were marginalized, myself included, you know.
You use a very important phrase earlier. You called it, in reference to Mabo, you called it the largesse of a lie.
Yeah.
Because I think what you've gone on to explain is, you know, there are several aspects to this lie. One is that there was this sense that, you know, people were going to lose their backyards because the Australian law had recognized a species of title called native title or Aboriginal title. And there was a sort of drummed up hysteria driven by. Go on.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's that point where we need to pause and think about the lie and how this country had the power to create the Mabo myth and to retain the Mabo myth for all of this time, and now manifested in native title, Iliuas, etc., which provide the very foundation for the ongoing dispossession, for the ongoing, the ongoing theft, the ongoing destruction of both law and land, and to reduce the capacity for First Nations peoples to take responsibility and care for country. Lawyers need to be challenged. Mm-hmm. I mean, I lawyers need to be challenged. Often I had the response from some very respected academics, great theorists, when trying to engage with them about the, you know, the lie of Mabo, often the response was, I don't, it's an area of law I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's that about?
So people pretending they don't get it. Yeah.
Great theorists in constitutional law, you know, regimes of power, as though it was a carved out kind of piece. And often that's a response to that's often a colonial response in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not an area I understand, but why don't people understand colonial violence and racism?
I just wanted to grab the point you made about, you know, academics, constitutional lawyers, etc., saying, oh, I don't understand native title, or that's in the too, I've had people say to me, oh, that's in the too hard basket, which is really astonishing, as you say, because you cannot have a legal system in Australia without that legal system having to account for its origins. And one of the really important things about Mabo, the Mabo case and the Mabo decision, is that the High Court had to narrate the origins of Australian law and demonstrate and bear witness to the fact that the foundation of Australian law was inherently racist, was inherently violent, but very importantly, as you say, it rendered this violence and in fact the dispossession that followed to a large extent non-justiciable. That is to say that no court, no tribunal would hold anyone to account for that violence and dispossession. So that was the disconnect between the rhetoric of, oh, people are going to lose their backyards in their city, in the cities, compared to what the decision was actually doing in terms of justifying dispossession, extinguishment of native title, and so on. You know, was extreme.
But voila was hailed a revolutionary decision of the High Court in giving recognition to an Aboriginal title, which was more about finding a way through the maze of the system itself being interrogated for and unable to answer the question, which is one, you know, I think that what I've landed in my long career in law is just the simple question of by what lawful authority? By what lawful authority? And how do you have that conversation across peoples, nations, Aboriginal peoples and the coloniser? And we know, they say the question is non-justiciable, but it can't just sit there. You can't answer that question with that response, that we can't look at it.
Yes.
We can't ever look at it, because if we look at it, we unsettle and dismantle, and we then must begin a process of decolonization. And then the web of connectivity comes into our awareness of, you know, the international relationships and the impossibility of decolonization it's a trajectory that must be considered. But in considering that, we can see that the relationship in international law with the Australian state, and the closing down or the closing off of the decolonisation committee, and the very limitations that are placed on decolonising processes. And that's where we've landed with many of the contemporary, what Australia went through, and the Australian government threw millions and millions of dollars at the recognition campaign, where it was just a chat show. You know, an open sort of chat show about recognition, you know, recognition in the Constitution. Well, you know, it's where's the kind of logic and the thinking about that as a process, when the very foundation of the Constitution is based on an unlawful foundation, and interconnected. So it's sort of, you know, to me, it's always felt like we're sort of, you know, layering over all of the cracks and gaps, anticipating that another layer of whatever will fix that. But the cracks and the failure to really think through what is a lawful foundation is something that we just walk away from. I mean, and that's a universal that's a universal question as well. You know, the very nature of law and what makes law and what makes what is lawful, and who's calling and determining what that is. And Australia is a wonderful case study of all of that.
Absolutely. I think we'll return to this question of lawfulness and your own sense of what it means to be lawful. I think that's the challenge, as you say, in relation to decolonization, but also it's very important in terms of First Nations law and the lawfulness that is present, notwithstanding the centuries of attempts to demolish and dismantle Aboriginal law. But I wanted to move on to what the Mabo case and native title enabled. And to a large extent, it was further dispossession, because what the system of native title introduced ultimately through the native title legislation that successive governments passed was a right to negotiate for Aboriginal peoples. And so the so-called right to negotiate with mining companies attempting to certainly successfully continuing with their extraction activities, so that a large part of the Native Title Act of 1993 and the Native Title Amendment Act of 1998 was all about enabling resource extractors, mining companies for the most part, to get on the ground on Aboriginal claimed land, native title claimed land, where there may not yet be a determination of native title. So there isn't a final decision on who owns the title, but mining companies can continue to get on the ground. So extraction has been the ultimate outcome, if you like, of this system of recognition. So I wanted you to perhaps reflect on that aspect. And I know you've been involved in a number of struggles, in a number of attempts to resist this and to draw attention to this process.
Yeah, the Indigenous land usage agreements have been, which are embedded in the native title legislation as a way of negotiating with developers and First Nations peoples has been effectively used, and as you say, Stuart, to propel the extractive industries process across Australia. You know, there are any number of examples: the expansion of Roxby Downs, the attempt on the to progress the Adani mine, gas fracking across the entire continent, the recent Rio Tinto fiasco in Western Australia. They're all at the root of these events, lay Indigenous land usage agreements, and some Aboriginal people will say, you know, that they've derived benefits from it. Many will show the destructive, not only the destruction that extractive industries and the overpowering of small communities by major corporations that are in this space, maneuvering and manipulating with immense power in the bargaining, negotiating, agreement space. You know, as lawyers, and many of these agreements are confidential in nature and binding on, and many of the lawyers in this space, I would argue, are conflicted. I'll also argue there are many forms of illegality that go on in the racist, colonialist way that Aboriginal peoples have been advised by their so-called legal representatives. It's quite a conflicted space. So it sets, and I'm not surprised, it's a part of the ongoing nature of colonial foundation. And the ongoing theft and destruction of land. Just take me back, Stuart. I think I've gone off track here.
You're right on point. I was just talking about how the extraction process and the extractive industries were enabled by the native title system, and you've been talking about the ILUAs, the Indigenous Land Use Agreements. And how they facilitated, in many ways, the acceleration of extraction, of mining operations, etc.
And I think that what the play has been here, you know, I mean, because in the, you know, a big conversation or a little bit of a chant about without the free, prior and informed consent of Aboriginal peoples. And so this was a real play in again, you know, the largesse of the lie of Mabo itself, of constructing, of manufacturing free, prior and informed consent, you know, in this process. And so lawyers working in this space and those who have some integrity and ethics really need to drill down and examine examine the nature of the power relationships, the nature of the agreements, and the also the very question in terms of Aboriginal law itself. And that is the question: can First Nations acting lawfully, and this is coming up over and over again with a number of First Nations groups, can they even agree or provide their consent to an unlawful destruction of country? So there's a collision, you know, of law. In a colonialist racist framework, we don't consider that Aboriginal peoples have law, which is, you know, embedded in the very notion of terra nullius.
Yes.
And that's what we see played out in Mabo, you know, is the ongoing embeddedness of terra nullius. I mean, you know, Mabo says itself, you know, that they've come up with a little trick way of recognising Aboriginal title where they keep everything that they've always had but look good, you know, that they, you know, that great, that they look good and look like it's a good act of recognition when there's, it, you know, the pantry's bare, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
It's an empty space and filled with lies of recognition.
Yeah.
So good lawyering needs to look at all of this and look at the ongoing embeddedness of terra nullius, which, you know, international law says it rejects. Well, it's not rejected in any of these spaces.
Yeah. The point you make about can Aboriginal lawfulness, Aboriginal law itself, which instructs a particular relationship to country, can it ever possibly authorize the destruction of country, the extraction of and shipping away of large bits of country? I mean, this is a really crucial point raise, and it's...
I say no. Many say no, and some say yes. It's and how do we have this conversation? We have this conversation within a restricted, contained within the colonial matrix. We can't ever have the freedom of freely having a proper, from an Aboriginal perspective, conversation about this, and because it's doused with, you know, oh, that's too extreme, you know, and why is it too extreme? Because the point is, nothing cannot disable the colonial project, and therein lay the problem, the universality of colonialism. So I would say no, because the core of Aboriginal law is the notion of relationality and connection and responsibility and obligations. And if my ngātchi is my relation, I have all of the kinship responsibilities that one has to taking care of. All of those things that I belong to and I'm made of. So, you know, the very notion of giving consent to the very destruction, the very genocide of oneself, surely Western legal thought and Western philosophy can come to understand that. And we're on the very precipice of actually doing that. You know, I mean, climate change.
Yes.
You know, profiteering out of warmongering. It's, we have the capacity and the ability to say no to all of that and to find another way of being in relationship with all things of this planet. Aboriginal peoples have been doing it forever. Slight pause this past more than 200 years because of a legal foundation that was different. So we do have models. We have ancient models of other ways of being lawful. Yet there's no space where we can have a proper conversation about that. And that's because the colonial matrix is what it is. Disabling of, and I'm not saying, you, of course, globally there are movements here and there, and there are those conversations. But in the way we're talking about law, where can we have that conversation? And international law, and you know, the UN, and they do, but they're completely disabled. I mean, there are all sorts of people, good people, working in those spaces, doing what they're trying to do. But it's completely itself within the colonial matrix itself. So where do we have a conversation about law not contained by colonialism?
Yeah, Irene, in your own work, you invoke the international quite a lot, and I think in the sense that First Nations ought to be seen as nations, and the relations that are at stake are international relations. So Australia, other colonial states ought to be discussing the history of colonialism and what decolonization might mean within a sort of international framework. And you have been involved in international conversations with other First Nations groups across the world. Do you see any possibilities for advancing those efforts in the foreseeable future?
I have great hope, and there are many opportunities. It's what we do. It's what we do ourselves every day. To think about our own positioning in all of this. The violence of colonialism and its ongoing impact here is immense in many ways. I could point, you know, that what's happening to children, to communities, the capacity for communities to even come together and have a lawful meeting is so impacted by, say, for example, the violence of native title. I have conversations. I had a recent conversation with a local elder asking me to think about developing an assembly of elders, and it's difficult to bring people together when they're so impacted by the violence and the politics of colonialism. But how do we do it? We do it by simply acting lawfully. I have great hope. I think there are opportunities for this planet, by people thinking about what does it mean to act lawfully and what does it mean to have lawful relations. We can still all do that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's quite, you know, it's abstract, and but I know it from my own experience, and that's a really hard, and going back to my earlier vision of community development and how it was so impossible because you're constantly grinding against a colonial violence that's set to annihilate always, to annihilate community, to assimilate community, not build community, but to destroy community, to disconnect people from countries so that it's easier for extractive industries, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not easy, but I'm hopeful because individuals can always determine to act lawfully and to be lawful and to encourage lawful relation.
The lawfulness and relationality that you speak about is really central to building hope in the context of climate change, which you referred to, the complete destruction of ecosystems, the extinctions of plants and animals that we're seeing across the world. And indeed, you yourself have participated in drawing attention to the acceleration of mining and extraction, the fracking exploration that is taking place and across Northern Australia, for instance. How do you think we might draw on the notion of relationality, by which I think you mean the relation between what we refer to as humans and non-humans, and that is probably not a distinction that you draw in your conception of lawfulness. Strong distinction between an autonomous human and a more docile, inanimate object, the subject-object distinction that is so central to Western epistemologies. How do you go about pushing the breaking down of that sort of distinction?
By simply being lawful and being being a being that acts upon and understands the truth of all of that connectivity. I know, again, that sounds, you know, I don't know what that sounds like, but it's the only truthful way I can express it. It's not. I don't think we can do this through theory, through theorizing it. We need to internalize and understand what this connection is. And I understand for the West that may be just about impossible. But as again, you know, when we talk about impossible, what's the alternative? We have little left but to really to know this, to know that water is sacred. That we need to understand and know the sacredness of ourselves and our connections to the natural world in the fullness of all of that, what that means. It's almost an impossible conversation to have, Stuart, to talk about it. I think that people just need to I think it's an impossible conversation to have because Aboriginal people have been trying to have it for how long? And things are worsening. So for me, the only truth is people need to get it, need to get it fast and to know it. That all the things that Aboriginal people have been saying forever is sacred to us is true. Is true because it's it's sacred to the ongoingness of our life and its life, and that's what makes it sacred. And it's, there's a relationship there. You can't, and unless we understand how we're connected, we don't understand, and the path of destruction is ongoing.
Yeah, I suppose it's the it's that place of the distinction between a kind of a realm of human action and what's called nature, and breaking down that separation that seems so central. And one of the ways in which this is happening through law, as I've mentioned to you, is giving legal personality, legal personhood to what would previously have been regarded as natural, geological, inanimate phenomena. So rivers, mountains have been given a legal personality. An example is the Whanganui River in New Zealand. Various animals are being granted standing, or there are campaigns to ensure that they have standing in court. But this is very much a way of bringing what is referred to as nature within a particular legal imagination. And I wanted to get your sense of that.
I would say it's bringing it into a colonial framework. And it's not that it's not unlike what happened in Mabo.
Yes.
Aboriginal peoples were flora and fauna and complete the justification for colonialism. So this is not unlike, and, you know, we were referred to as akin to the flora and fauna. And I've often corrected or had a conversation with some younger Aboriginal people who've said, well, you know, that's an insult. And I said, well, you know what? I don't think it is. I think it's the truth that, you know, the early colonial set were right on, you know, that we're akin to the flora and fauna.
Interesting.
And that's the truth. That's the truth. Mm-hmm. The old people wouldn't have had a problem with that. Mm-hmm. What the problem was the violence of colonialism. Mm-hmm. Not the characterization.
And the hierarchy. And the hierarchy that came with that characterization.
So I think that therein lay the problem with the recognition of providing, because it's providing a forum for the song and dance of recognition of the natural world to get played out. But the problem lay with who's going to determine what is and what isn't a justiciable question in law, which we've already seen. So I think that the way we might think about that is what we've already seen in Mabo, and is the likely scenario is what I think about that. But it's not a question of recognition. It's a question of getting to understand that our we are related to the flora and fauna, and we're all connected. And that there's that's the lawfulness of an Aboriginal being is the knowing of that and the acting out of the obligations and responsibilities. Questions of recognition. I mean, who cares about recognition? It's a question of being able to be connected and be alive and sustain for our futures that are coming. And we've got to a point where we can't confidently say that anymore. And if we're not thinking that this is core to our thinking about law and what is core to our thinking about law and lawfulness, then, hey, I don't know what is.
Well, Irene, this has been wonderful to have this conversation with you about all of these issues, reflecting on the past, but also thinking about more lawful ways in which we might encounter the present and the future. Your work, your writing, the conversations I've had the privilege of having with you in numerous different places and parts of the world have been always a great inspiration and education to me. And I know that listeners of Countersign would really value this interview with you. So thank you so much for your time and generosity.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you for your work as well in bringing these important conversations together.
Thanks, Irene.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.